p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
A very good evening and welcome to Behind the News, our news and current affairs program, which examines issues from the perspective of newsmakers and experts. My name is Ibrahim Oponkwate, and tonight they are the custodians of offenders the courts convict to serve various jail terms. The custodians being referred to are personnel of the Ghana Prison Service. What kind of change is the service effecting to live up to its reformative rule? You'll hear live from the Acting Director General of the Prisons Service. The Chief Umpire of the 2012 general elections today took his turn in the witness box in the petition case at the Supreme Court. What did he tell the presiding judges and the parties to the case? And winner takes all in Ghana's politics. Is it an albatross for national development? And now to our first story on prisons. The perception of the country's prisons as places of doom is still strong in the minds of many Ghanaians. Issues of congestion, deprivation, and instances of human rights abuses of prisoners have often been cited as some of the reasons that have gone to entrench this perception. But the service is now trying to tell a different story, which will shift from punitive to correctional interventions. How ready is the service in positioning itself strategically to contribute to national development? Behind the News finds out more about this new paradigm shift from the first woman acting director general of the prison service, Madam Matilda Balfour. Well, Madam, you are welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you very much, Ibrahim.
So let me begin by congratulating you on being the first acting woman director general of the Ghana Prison Service. And how does it feel to take up that responsibility?
Oh, thank you very much. Well, like you rightly said, it's a big responsibility. As a woman, you know, the perception is that women are not into leadership positions as far as the uniform services are concerned. And this is the first time a woman is being given the opportunity, and I think everybody is watching me, and I have to prove myself.
Right, we wish you well, but let's go straight to the issues. Madam, there is this perception of the prisons as a place of doom. Let me even add distraction, if you want. But we understand the focus of the service has shifted from punitive to reformation or correctional. What has been the motivation for this shift?
Okay. You agree with me that for the past 10 years now, the prison service has been grappling with this new paradigm shift from punitive to corrections. We really want to go this corrections way because we have found out that warehousing prisoners, that is putting prisoners behind bars without any intervention, do not augur well for the society, because most of the time these prisoners come out and they are even worse off than before. So the new approach is to make sure that the prisoners in our custody are exposed to interventions such as education, vocational training, and then the underlying causes of their offending behavior. It could be drug and alcohol abuse or excessive anger or even psychological problems. So this is what we are addressing ourselves to at this moment.
Right, madam. But now let's look at the issue of congestion, which is the first referral point. Anytime issues concerning the prisons are brought to the fore, how serious is the issue and how do you intend tackling it?
Yes. Congestion is a big problem in the prisons now. We've heard over and over again that the prisons is over congested, and that we have exceeded our capacity over about 40%. In the central prisons like Sawan prisons, Ho prisons, Kumasi and Sekendi, sometimes it's very difficult for prisoners to find space to sleep. So the congestion is very, very high, and it could be attributable to the high remand population we have on our hands.
Mm.
So what we intend to do now is to reclassify the prisoners we have in custody to find out which of them have low security levels so that we can put them in the open camp prisons. You know, we have farm settlement camps and then open camp prisons for low security risk prisoners. this is where we intend to put people who have brushed with the law for the first time, who have gone through the criminal system with petty offenses, and who are about to, some of them who are about to go on release. You put them there. Then we also look at the situation where we can transfer the high security risk prisoners to anchor for the newly commissioned high security prison, which was built to cater for about 2,500 prisoners. Now, we've just sent about 280 prisoners there. We are waiting for housing units to be built for our staff so that we can now offload more of the prisoners into that facility. Then you'll be encouraging the government or the president to come out with amnesties for certain categories of prisoners, like those who are aged and those who are sick, and those who do not pose any security risks to the society. These people could also be given amnesties so that the prisons are less crowded.
Right. Madam, before you leave us, human resource, you agree, is critical in achieving your set goal. And in what ways are you getting the needed personnel on board to help in bringing the envisaged reforms to fruition?
Yes. We have a lot of experts on hand. We have agriculturalists, we have architects. These special people could actually help with the vocational training that we are giving to the inmates. We have so many fertile lands all over the country. Mm. We have some at Polipoli, we have some at Gayonkanta, Niawa, and Linwa. And we could put the prisoners to good use of these farms, be able to feed business well, and even support the local market. We are also thinking of maybe partnering the estate developers in putting up houses. We have architects. We have building construction personnel. So we could come out and help put up houses for the staff. And even on the local market, we are here when we saw people from China, I mean prisoners from China, to come over here and build fine edifices for us.
Right.
We have also trained our prisoners, and we think we could come up and help the government in the socio-economic development of this country.
Mm. Madam, I had wanted to discharge you, but then let's help me out with these two issues. Why is this perception of the prisons as a place of doom have gained some so much strength in society?
Yes. You know, prisons are always seen as negative areas. It actually rings a negative bell in everybody's mind. Nobody wants to hear of prisons because we harbor people who have been convicted of crimes, who we think are wayward people. We don't want to have anything to do with it. But I can assure you that under this administration, everything is going to change because we want to come out and tell the public that prisons can also positively contribute towards the society. We want to go low on the negative things like escapes and prisons being non-productive and all that. So my administration is going to make sure that we use this medium that I'm using now, mass media, and even our staff to go out and educate the public about the positive things in the prison service. I just talked about having agriculturalists and a large tract of land. We could actually produce to help feed our prisoners and even the country.
So, madam, your last one. When there is an amnesty, how do you do the selection? Who benefits and so on?
The amnesty is for, I told you, is for special category of prisoners. Normally, when we have to release prisoners into the society, we have to assure the public that these people will not come and terrorize them. So amnesty is not given to anybody at all. It is maybe somebody is very seriously sick and he has gone before a medical board and the medical board has certified that the person is actually sick or the person is so old and firm and he needs to go to his family for recuperation or something like that. Or the person might have committed petty offenses and spent about a considerable time of the jail sentence in prison before we release these people into society. We just don't release anybody at all to the society.
Right, Madam Matilda Bafo, we really appreciate your time with us, and we wish you well in your new position.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us on the line to tell us more about the feasibility of this transition, but we're having a feedback, which means that Prof, who is expected to join us, we now have on the line a sociologist, Professor Kuju Sena, to tell us more about the feasibility of this transition. Prof, you are welcome.
Thank you very much.
Prof, the prison service has its first female acting director general. Anything striking about that, given the role of that institution in justice and delivery chain?
Oh, certainly the prison service is an important institution of state. It is meant to sanction those who go against the law, not only to sanction them, but also to reform them so that they can improve the community. That's basically the
Prof, could you kindly reposition yourself? Can hardly hear you.
Okay. There's a problem with my phone. That's one. Can you hear me now?
It's better, Prof.
It's better, okay.
So we continue. You are an expert on prison matters. Which areas will you recommend to the authorities of the prison, especially Madam, to focus more in her new role?
Sorry, I didn't get the initial part of the issue.
Right. So Prof, let's take the questions again. I'm saying the prison service has its first female acting director general. Anything striking about that, given the role of that institution in justice delivery chain?
Well, that's what I'm saying, that it is very significant. But we need to contextualize it and say that the prison service is a very important agency of the state. When people go against the law, they have to be sanctioned so that those who conform will be encouraged to continue to conform. But at the same time, when we are sanctioning those who go against the law, we need to have in mind that they should be rehabilitated and not given further punishment. So, yes, we welcome the new director. We think he would be able to put through all kinds of measures so that at the end of the day, we have a prison service that we can all be proud of.
Right, Prof. The service is now trying to tell a different story, which is shifting from punitive to correctional interventions. How do you think the service is ready in positioning itself strategically to contribute to national development?
Well, the service has always said it, you know, that as it is the popular thing, you know, people are sent to prison, or at least in criminology, that's what we say. People are sent to prison not for further punishment, but for rehabilitation. But in our case, our circumstances are such that people go to prison and are punished further. For instance, how do you feed a prisoner on, I don't know how much, maybe 4 cities or 2 cities a day? How do you put so many people in prison? So one prison is supposed to take about 700 and something people. I'm sure now it takes over 2,000 people. How do you reform people when you give them, when you put them under this condition? It's just not possible.
So, Prof, which areas will you recommend to the authorities of the prison, especially Madam, to focus more in her new role?
Well, those who go to prison because they have no job to do, it will be very important for us to give them some kind of job orientation. I would suggest that the prison service, you know, will look around, perhaps partner with a private company, you know, that can assist them, you know, to provide all kinds of training in the prison. In European, you know, your American circles, people go to prison and come out with degrees. You know, they are educated. They also want to learn trade. People should be given the opportunity to learn trade. But here, we don't have it.
Right, Prof, we have often complained about lack of teachers in most schools and other professionals, but it will interest you to know that there are some of these professionals serving various jail terms in the countries and prisons, wasting, eating and drinking. Is there a way society can be made to benefit from these people without compromising their sentences?
Yes, so that's why everybody is talking about the community service now. There's no need to put somebody in prison for 6 months when they are selling maybe one good. If he is a professional, or if we can use his services, why don't we put him to community service? Why don't we allow them to clean a craft, you know, by collecting garbage, cleaning the gutters, and doing all that, instead of keeping them there you know, and just whisk them away. So, yes, we need to do more community selling. So allow the prisoners to do more community selling instead of keeping them.
Prof, if the prison authorities get the opportunity to get such professionals to help society, for instance, a teacher being sent to the classroom, what do you think could be society's reaction, especially pupils who find out that the person before them teaching is serving a jail term?
Oh, you see, when you are serving a jail term, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are such a criminal, you know, to the whole. There are very many people in prisons who are there because they didn't have clever lawyers to defend their case. There are very many people over there who, you know, just who went to file on the law, you know, on very small issues. If we as a community, as a nation, begin to see business as just any ordinary people, I think, you know, all this stigma that they carry will go away. In America, if you say you are being jailed, it is nothing.
Right. Prof, your final one. And now let us come to your area, sociology. What pushes prisoners who return to society after serving their jail terms under difficult conditions to engage in even more heinous atrocities?
So you see, the problem is that all of us are creations of the society in which we live. Nobody is born a criminal, nobody is born a good thief, nobody is born a liar. Because the circumstances you find yourself in that, you know, allow you to do the kind of thing you are doing. So, if somebody goes to prison, it doesn't mean, therefore, that he is such a terrible person. We can reform him. We can do that if we really need to do it. But then, we allow the people to go to prison. They come out, then the stigma is on them. And when they live in society, anything that goes wrong, they say, hey, he has just arrived. Please, look, search him and see whether he's the one. No. We all must put our hands on sick and ensure that these people are rehabilitated. After all, they are as human as we are. We are lucky to be outside the prison because we haven't committed the offense that will put us straight in the arms of the law. But I tell you, every Ghanaian will confess that at one point in time, in his lifetime or her lifetime, he or she has done something to America in getting prison term.
Right. So we are all potential candidates for prison. Prof, we would want to thank you very much for your contribution tonight.
Thank you very much.
Professor Kuju Sena is a sociologist. And now to our second story. Most Ghanaians are transfixed to their television sets religiously following the election petition hearing at the Supreme Court. Many have voiced concerns over this, believing the problem may be affecting man hours at work and general productivity. But how did we get here in the first place? To some astute minds, all these could have been avoided if the country's governance system is extricated from parochial issues. Issues like sharing positions to party cronies and loyalists and dismissing public servants who have nothing to do with politics. This is what is referred to in Ghanaian political circles as the winner-takes-all syndrome. Eminent personalities like Justice V.C.R.A.C. Crabb and Professor Justice A.K. Paku Kluge, all retired Supreme Court judges, have on one or more occasions spoken against the phenomenon. Former Gimpa Rector Professor Stephen Adair even put it bluntly when he said earlier this year that the issue is negatively affecting the quality of leadership and the progress of our democracy. To Professor Kluge, it is the bane of the country's politics, adding that it has been carried to such a ridiculous extent as to distort the whole machinery of government. So tonight on Behind the News, we are asking if this bane can be overcome someday. Let us kick off the discussions with Professor Stephen Adai, who has joined us on phone. Prof, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Prof, I'm sure everybody has his own way of defining winner takes all. How do you describe or define it?
Because everybody has a way of
defining winner takes all. We want your perspective.
Oh, the winner takes all.
Exactly.
Well, to be honest, even I don't like that term winner takes all, because actually they were not supposed to win and take all. So therefore, that by itself is a description of a totally wrong thing.
Mm.
But basically, when people talk about winner take all, the tendency that once the day election is won, even toilets, the management of toilets are changed to party cronies, all positions, political and non-political, bureaucratic and administrative are changed on board of public corporations. Nobody has anybody the authority that when you become your party wins, all public corporation heads and managing directors will come from your party. Especially when you win, nobody wins by more than 50% of Ghanaians voting for them. And that is this the final.
Hello, Prof. We unfortunately seem to have lost Professor Stephen Adair. We're trying to get back to him. But before that, let's take... So we have Professor Stephen Adair back on the line. Prof, we are happy to have you back.
I'm sorry for that, but that's Ghana Telecom.
Right, Prof. So you were making a point about the description of the winner takes all and so on. So what do you have to add to that?
Actually, I wasn't too sure when even the line went off, so I hope...
You're still talking?
Yes, but basically, as I said, you know, the tendency for once the party wins there, we want to occupy all government positions, even public sector positions, all boards, somebody with only people whom they consider to be their loyal party members. Mm-hmm. That is the winner takes all, and totally wrong, because actually that most of the things they do is illegal. I don't think that it is right for a senior public servant to lose his position because there is a new government, and I believe that people should challenge it in the courts.
Prof,
but,
I'm sorry to cut in rudely, but there is this school of thought that also believes that a new government comes in, and the tendency to keep people who are perceived as having political leanings to the previous government could undermine the new government.
That is absolutely false. It's against a pretext to do what is wrong. There are certain positions. Nobody expects an NDC government to appoint an NPP ideologue as a minister or to be certain sensitive positions to be his chief of staff. That's not what we are talking about. But there's no reason why, when there's a public toilet in Obuasi, and then somebody is managing it, and you come and say that now is the time for you to let my party member to come and be it, or a public servant, we have to define, maybe if you want to say that the chief directors are the principal and who may, but this idea of going down and almost making everybody who has made risen through their profession to the top immediately anathematized, to say that, and oftentimes it's not a question of whether you are NPP or NDC. If you don't publicly declare that you support them, the normal, sensible, professional public servant should not do that.
Prof,
therefore, they should not be penalized for that. I'd like to think that we must have a constitutional amendment to define which positions are political and which positions one cannot allow the politicians to meddle with.
Prof, let's situate the discussion in a different context by, let me say, hypothetically, I'm bringing you on board. If you were to win an election in Ghana, if you were to become president, looking at the vitriolic nature of our politics, would you appoint someone other than from your party?
Yes, because, first of all, let us define it. I think that 90% of Ghanaians at all levels have no political connection, in the sense that when they are in a position, they will use it to sabotage their government. I can say the head of Kulebi or the Kabio, when he's not in your party, is he going to kill people because they are NDC or NPP? Absolutely rubbish to think that way. So there are certain positions which has nothing to do with politics. We are talking about, I want to appoint somebody as my chief of staff, whom I'm not absolutely sure is on my side. But there's no reason why, when somebody is managing Gihok Distillery, he said that he's not my party member, or somebody is the chairman of National Accreditation Board, he said he's not my party member. So that, you know, when NDC time, we had Professor Champon heading National Accreditation Board, a retiree about 70 years or so, then when there's a change of government, the government comes in, they remove the National Accreditation Board chairman, and then go and bring the same person there and continue his. So if I don't see how who is the chairman of a National Accreditation Board to wear an NDC or NPP color. It's a professional tertiary education management issue. Ghana Education Service and all those things. So it is those levels that becomes a concern to me. But I don't expect the NDC to appoint an NPP as a deputy minister. And then we are talking about the union government. Let politicians appoint people to political positions, but there must be a certain position whereby the 90% of Ghanaians who are not wearing party colours will not be penalized because they haven't worn the ruling party's colours.
Right, Prof. This may be the objective and position, but others believe that if Professor Stephen Adair were to take that line of action, he wouldn't go beyond his first term in office. But hold on briefly for us
if I deliver development, listen, for example, I've been one of my pet subjects because it's dear to me. If within 2 years, and I think that in 2 years we can make almost every child in primary school literate, the parents would vote for me, not on because I've appointed, after how many people does the government appoint into political positions? And the answer is, we are talking about at most 500. We are talking about 25 million Ghanaians. When I improve their situation, when I reduce their poverty, when their roads are fixed, when Dumiso becomes, instead of Dumiso, maybe for some time, it will not, you cannot stop it overnight.
Right, Prof. Before we continue the Dumiso and the Dumiso, could you
focus on development.
Right. Prof, could you, the discussion is becoming interesting. So could you hold on briefly for me whilst I seek the views of other people? How do we overcome this problem? Let us tap the expertise of Dr. Franklin Odru of the CDD, who has also joined us on phone. Doc, you are welcome. Hello, Doc. I'm afraid we don't have Doc. Yeah, Doc, you're welcome.
What is fault is the Ghana Telecoms.
Right, Prof. So Prof, let's continue with you whilst we try to get Dr. Odru on board. So you are making a point.
When Ghanaians see a government who is improving the education system, their health system, their road system, reducing corruption to the barest minimum, I don't think that we can eliminate corruption. But the corruption in Ghana, which is costing so dearly, can be reduced by 80% within a short time, and people go in for services and they get in within time, they will vote for you. And if you are NDC government, the NDC people will see your good works. Unfortunately, you will win and some MPPs on your side because they will know.
Right. Prof, I haven't discharged you yet, but we are told that Dr. Franklin Odru is on the line. So just hold on for us. We'll get back to you. Doc, you're welcome. Hello, Dr. Odru. Hello?
Yeah, good evening.
Right, Doc. Doc, people are condemning the winner takes all phenomenon, but who will like to appoint his enemies?
Well, first of all, I mean, thank you for the opportunity and good evening to your listeners. I think your question, as to who will appoint your enemy doesn't.
Let me put enemies in quotes because we don't have enemies.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do understand that, but you know, again, I think we should understand that we are talking about governance of a nation. And governing a nation is towards the betterment of citizens. And therefore, if you want to appoint competent people, you don't have to look at the argument that this person is not from a political party or is not from my camp. I think that is the pain of our democratic development currently in Ghana. One of the main governance deficits that we are currently facing is the way we manage power, the way we distribute power, and the way we use it for enhancing the development of this country.
Mm. Doc, let me put you hypothetically on the seat of government as president, because others, I believe that these submissions are theoretical and that you need to go onto the ground to see how practically some of these issues are. Would you appoint people who are opposed to you? I'm using you once again as a test case. Appoint people who are opposed to your views.
No. See, the point you're asking is that you are appointing competent people who you think can help you steer the affairs of this country.
But are opposed to your views, no matter how competent they are.
Well, no, it's not a question of opposing. I think we should look at this question of winner takes all from a different perspective. It's not a question of appointing someone who is opposing your views or doesn't share your political philosophy. It's a question of appointing people who you can bring on board to help deliver the goods for the citizens, for this country. Now, your question, hypothetically, would I appoint someone who is opposed to my views? Well, in theory, you might say that why should I bring somebody who doesn't share or doesn't believe in my philosophy or the things that I want to do? I think you may make that argument that this person, once you bring the person on board, is not going to be part of you. You probably work to derail your progress. Fair enough. But that is not the fundamental issue about winner takes all that we need to look at. It's about the excessive powers that the presidency holds in this country. What legally and constitutionally, the powers that have sort of been concentrated in the hands of the executive, that makes the presidency or the president or the executive appoint almost everybody in this country, which allows little room to bring people from different positions or different angles, and also doesn't allow multi-party endorsement of appointments. So, for instance, we do have a situation where appointment to certain offices doesn't even have supermajority of parliamentary members. You see, when we are talking about ways to avoid winner takes all, what we need to look at is to the degree that appointments of officials are done in a way that allow opposition parties or minority parties to have input into such appointment. So why can't we, for instance, the appointments of the chair to the Commission on Human Rights and Administrative Justice or the Electoral Commission or certain state institutions, can't we make it with some kind of two-thirds prior approval from Parliament, which would then allow even minority parties to engage in the decision-making processes that will lead to appointment of someone that will serve this country.
Right.
If we reduce the appointment functions to the presidency, then obviously it creates room for the president to appoint people who he thinks are in my camp and people who may unfortunately not be able to perform. And I think that is the issue that we need to tackle, that the winner-takes-all culture is rooted in our permissive structures, our constitution, our law, and at all levels. And if we don't address this culture, then it will have the effects that we are facing in this country.
Right, Doc, let's come back to you as president, Dr. Franklin Oduro, as president. You will look for competent people, deliver development, and then lose your first term in office, no matter the consequences. I want a brief answer to that.
Well, I think at some point, in this is where we need to confront. I mean, you know, again, hypothetically, if I'm a president and I want to serve my country, I want to leave a legacy, I shouldn't be thinking about another 4 years of election for me as Franklin.
Right.
I should be looking at what I can do to serve a president for this country. Even if I lose the next 4 elections, at least my conscience would have told me that I've done something for this country.
Dr. Franklin Oduro, I'm sorry to cut in, but then let me allow you, I'm making a point. I wanted to move to Professor Stephen Ade, who has been on the line for a very long time. So if you could be a bit brief for us on this one.
No, the point I was trying to say is that I think we have been looking at elections, you know, and that's the thing that's driving this lunatic. So we have sort of reduced our electoral competition to state capture, and therefore our aim as political parties or leaders is always the next election. And it's not about doing something right for this country, even if it means appointing people who can do the right thing, rather than appointing people who we think belong to our party or our group.
Right, Doc, we want to thank you very much for your contribution. Prof, I'm sure you are still there.
Yes, I am.
And I know you are very passionate about some of these things. So how do we get over this problem of winner takes all without apportioning blame here and there?
Well, I think that, first of all, we may have to look at our constitution again. And then, as Kenyans have done, they have limited the scope of the presidency, because I think that must be looked at. I think that number two, we must define again constitutionally what are the positions which a president comes and goes with. And that must be clear. The president does not come and go with who is the rector of Dimba or who is the head of Kolebu, or he comes and goes with the people he formulates policies and the key implementers. And we must define that one. And that in so doing, we must balance, of course. There are certain positions, as I said, ministers, deputy ministers, chief of staff, and that. But you cannot say that every senior public service position will do. And it's sad that
on the line. Hello, Prof. We seem to have lost Professor Stephen. But let's move on to Minister for Parliamentary Affairs and Majority Leader in Parliament, Dr. Benjamin Kumbo. Doc, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Doc, how do we address this issue of winner takes all in our body politics?
Well, what you are seeing in the so-called winner takes all is just a symptom of a bigger malaise in our social system. And that is one over the years that we have been shying away from and we've not been able to address. The reasons for it are many, but there are a number of things that we are missing as a nation. The first one is that we have an incomplete national project, in which we are supposed to be communal traditionally, but that communality is supposed to be embedded in what has come to be known as ethnocentrism, in which you even have ethnic entrepreneurs. And so that is one of the aspects. The second thing is that why should public service be one in which you are having arrangements of taking? Why should there be things for people to take, so that it becomes a winner-take-all? There are many aspects of this development that I think for me have been worrying. And I look at it from so many angles. And you can find a lot of interesting things in our body politic, in our society. This is a country in which we pay people so well to talk, but we don't pay people well enough to think. Now, a society that becomes a talk shop and one that doesn't involve people who think, that society is running into a lot of problems. And that is why all this, what I would consider medieval politics, is having its way in this country. I keep hearing people talk about this winner-take-all and take. It is embedded in our very social structure.
Mm.
And the earlier we start thinking, and our social scientists should begin to work on a very, very interesting area that only external researchers are working on, the intra-elite politics that we have. It is so destructive. It is one that is not geared towards social progress in the country. And I think that we have to find a way to begin to get people to think and not just to talk.
So, Doc, how do we find a way? You just said we should find a way. How do we bring everybody on board the national development train?
Yeah, why is our politics so fractious? Why is it that even after you've gone through democratic elections, you have the entire country with a lot of fault lines always around politics? Why is it that the national interest has never become a center stage for bipartisan discussion? And that's why I'm saying that is embedded in our entire social system. And we have to get people to begin to analyze what really leads to this thing and this negative phenomena of a winner takes all. In fact, what is interesting in this monolithic winner takes all is that it is not indeed true. Even within political parties, there are losers in that political those political parties. So it becomes clear that there is a particular internal social arrangement and political arrangement, and they become the takers. And I must say, if I'll put it on the lighter side, they are even becoming undertakers. When you are running an economic system and the economy is screaming, the economy is running into problems, what is there for anybody to take? And I say that perhaps it's a winner-take-all and winner-undertakers that we have. And we have to move away from that. I have spent my own time going into and doing a lot of analysis, doing projections for the next 10, 15 years. What is the politics of this country going to look like?
And can you share some of these with us briefly?
Yes, precisely. What will happen in this country eventually is that many, many people who want to think and not just talk will disengage from our democratic process. When they do, it is going to be the crooks who will take over your political arrangement, and this country is finished. The signals are beginning to come. The level of monetization in our democracy. Somebody, the dichotomy between men of substance and men of straw. If you don't contribute financially to a political arrangement of your party, regardless of the level of ideas that you have, those ideas don't matter. In fact, those ideas even become irritants to some people. That is the onset of all this winner-take-all. And I'm saying that qualify that winner-take-all because I can tell you, if you take my own party, the number of people who have done a lot of things, they are not winners and they are not taking all. So don't let us look at it as if it's a monolithic party A, party B, and when party A wins, everybody in party A that has won is a taker. No! Let's open it up and let people know that there are even losers within the so-called winner-take-all. And I think that is the way we must operationalize this concept.
Continue, Doc.
Yes, and then that then puts us into a broader and a more scientific analysis to make us make a distinction between the individual trees in the forest. What we are talking about now is a forest. But individual trees make that forest. And the condition of those individual trees are not the same. And that's why I'm saying that we should be thinking. We should be doing more thinking than just talking.
Right,
the winner takes all is talking. Mm. It is not about thinking.
I've really enjoyed your analysis, especially the philosophical part. So are you planning of maybe holding a forum that will bring on board all stakeholders, share some of these with Ghanaians so that at least we can change our perceptions and our thinking towards national development?
Yeah, you know, one of the things people don't know is that when I have discussions with a lot of people in academia, you that's why I say you are going to have, I give you just one part of it. Either all the thinkers decide to disengage from politics and let the crooks take over the politics and let them run it as business as usual. Alternatively, you are going to have some thinkers who say, no, we are not going to disengage from it, but we are going to force people to join the critical conversation to just for the betterment of this country in the future. And I know if you watch the number of civil society organizations that are beginning to emerge, if you watch individual think tanks, they are beginning to engage a number of issues. And I know that you are definitely the typologies of those civil society organizations are bound to change. They are not just going to be ones that become megaphones for political parties, but they are going to be ones that are now saying that let us put the national project on the agenda. Let us make sure that Ghana matters and that anybody else's idiosyncrasies will not matter. When you build a critical mass around those type of people, then you are beginning to have a very sanitized way of moving our democracy forward. Let me tell you something. One institution that is missing in this country is the Center for Strategic Studies, where every shade of academic and intellectual opinion, regardless of their politics, are there. That is where your early warning systems are. Just take one and every economic or social problem that we find, call it Fulani herdsmen, call it burning of markets, call it your exchange rate deflation. All these things, the seeds have been sown 10, 15 years ago. We are only reaping them now. And just because people just don't want to think, they just pick what they have found out today, and they are beginning to engage them as if those problems started today and emerged today. If you do a proper historical analysis of each problem, in terms of both its internal and external dimensions, you will be dealing with a scientific way of solving these problems. But we go for the lazy and unscientific approach to it, in which people just get up on the radio stations, they make noise, and those noise don't reach us anywhere. You tell me when you listen to a radio station in the morning on a critical national issue, by the time the commentators finish, what has this country learned? Is anybody telling this country that from what we have analyzed in a purely partisan manner, this is the way forward as a national project? That is how we should be assessing our engagement. And I believe in this theory that a country that just pays people to talk, and you don't even pay people to think, or you don't pay them that well to think, that country is in danger.
Right. Doc,
and that is what is worrying me about this country.
Right, Doc, we'd want to thank you very much. But I propose that perhaps you come up with a book that will guide some of us on some of these issues. We'd want to thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And also joining us on the line is Lawyer Kwame Jantua of the CPP. Lawyer, you're welcome.
Thank you.
We've been trying to reach you, but unfortunately, this is the time that we have you on the line, so we may not be able to give you much time. But then
it's a network problem.
Fine. So tell us.
No Ghanaian company is handling any of these networks.
Right. So lawyer, tell us the winner takes all syndrome. Is it? How do we get over this thorny issue?
I really don't think that Ghana has got to the stage where they understand this winner-take-all situation. You know, I believe that immediately after elections, we should all put our hands to the wheel and build this nation. And gradually, I'm beginning to think that do we understand what we're doing? And really and truly, we should have some kind of, and a lot of people don't think that is right, some kind of coalition or union type government, this country, where we pull the brains from each party to put this country on its tracks. You know, I believe that one of the things we don't have in this country is a development plan that would target our resources properly to the right projects. And we're doing everything willy-nilly by party. Party agenda, and it's party this, and it's party that. And it's our party people, and it's our, it has to stop somewhere. It can't continue like this forever and ever. Because we're getting to a point where this country is going to be at a standstill and at a crossroads. So where do we go? Where do we go?
I wanted to ask you the same question. So where do we go?
The way we are going, we would reach a point where we now become desperate. Because nothing seems to be working. Absolutely nothing seems to be working. There's no money. People's work is, you know, somehow, you know, education is down the drain. Health is somewhere else. We have to sit down and get all stakeholders together and ask ourselves, what is it we want for our country? And work towards that.
Right.
And I believe it's not one person. It's an amalgamation of all stakeholders. And the people should get behind and move this country forward. Otherwise, we have nothing. We have no factories. We have nothing. All that we have is imports. Even human resource. We have human resource in this country. What are we doing with the human resource?
Right. We wish you could continue. But as you can see, we don't have much time on our side. So we give it a platform another day. We'd want to thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, sir.
That was Lawyer Kwame Jantua of the CPP. And now to our final story. The chairman of the Electoral Commission, Dr. Kwaju Afarijan, has told the Supreme Court that failure of presiding officers to follow the guidelines in completing the pink sheets amounts to an irregularity. He said there are portions on the form that are supposed to be filled before polls are open, while other portions are to be filled after polls have been closed, but before counting and the last portions after counting. Dr. Afarijan, who was given his evidence in chief for the Electoral Commission in the presidential election petition, also stated that in order to promote transparency, agents of the candidates are accorded great importance. Dr. Afarijan also touched on registration of Ghanaians abroad, registration of voters without fingers, distribution of ballot papers, and transmission of results to the EC strong room. Here is a report by Bubu Klinogo and George Asikri.
Dr. Kwaju Afarijan debunked the notion that agents of political parties or their candidates are just mere observers or exalted observers. According to him, the agents play a significant role in ensuring a proper conduct of the elections. It is for that reason he stated that the commission spent huge sums of money in training the agents.
The importance that we accord to the agents, for sure we don't regard them as observers. Observers of whether they are local or international, or exalted or whatever, have no right to sign the pink sheet or to make a protest, a formal protest, against an election at a polling station. The fact that party agents have this right would seem to suggest to me that it is wrong to describe them in any form of observer status. So far as we are concerned, the agents form part of the team that is entrusted with responsibility for making sure that the elections are run properly at the polling station. In fact, our law recognizes that and states that party agents or candidate agents or whatever you want to call them risk perjury if they do not do their work in accordance with the law. This cannot be said of observers of any description.
Dr. Afarijan also indicated that it is possible for errors to occur during the collation of results at the constituency centers, hence the need for representatives of the parties to be vigilant.
Let me say that there are two errors that can easily be committed at the collation center, and we call them in election language transposition errors. And let me tell you that some of these things have occurred. A transposition error would be, remember, you have a number of candidates, the two forms of transposition errors. my scores have been entered against another candidate, and maybe that some other candidate's scores have been entered against me. That would be a transposition error, particularly if care is not taken in arranging the candidates. If the candidates are not arranged in the same way on the collation form as they are arranged on the polling station form, that is the pink sheet, it could easily give rise to a transposition error.
That was the chairman of the Electoral Commission, Dr. Kwaju Afarijan, ending that report by Bubu Klinogo and George Asik. That's how we draw the curtains on today's edition of the program. We are back same time tomorrow. Production was by Edmond Tete, Bright Agama, Felix Kofi, and Christopher Asir, with Gifty Broom, our sound controller, and Samuel Issa bringing us the summary. My name is Ibrahim Oponkwate.